CliffCentral.com.
All righty. It is Wednesday morning, CliffCentral.com. I mentioned this just a second ago, but you know what? I'm starting to this is about the time of the year where you don't get too charmed and you don't take too seriously those people who are still on holiday. And I know we started on Monday, and some people probably thought that was a bit late. You know, Mbulelo and Simpiwe were here the week before already. And then there are people who will only get to work next week. And there's some people who, like, January is January is really up to you, you know. It's not it's not compulsory for many people. And those are the people we need to shame, I feel. Like, next week you should be getting back to work, don't you think?
Publicly as well. Unlike the matric results, we must shame them publicly.
Mm-hmm. We will publish your name in the newspaper.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to my mind is, what drugs do you sell? Like, the fact that you're not at work this week, what drugs are you selling, mate? What are you doing behind the scenes, you know? Like,
well, I think that there are probably a few very smart people, and I often look at these people in awe because I've never been able to make these decisions. Those people who work through Christmas and New Year, and then when they get back in January, as soon as we all get back, they take leave. Now, I do admire those people because they know about delayed gratification. Plus, they also know that things are cheaper in January at the shops because they're trying to sell stuff they didn't sell through Christmas and New Year. They know that a lot of accommodation, if you're going on holiday, is probably cheaper because it's off-season. You know, everybody's back already, so the prices come down. Flights are cheaper. There's a lot that comes down in price. So those are very, very smart people. I do look up to and admire those people. I'm not including you in this name and shame thing. All I'm saying is there needs to come a time, and I spoke to Yaku yesterday after the Catalytic show unbundled. He came into my office, and we sat for like a, I don't know, felt like maybe a half an hour, but it was probably like 10 minutes. And we were just bitching about how, you know, some people take them so long to get into the year. Like, I'm excited and I'm energetic and I'm ready for 2022 and there's a lot to look forward to. And I want to now get wheels turning and make things happen. But there are still people that are like, you can hear when they answer their phone, they're like, I don't know. Like, but haven't you... You know what I'm talking about. But haven't you just had a holiday? And they're like... Yeah, but it takes me a while to get into it. Come on, Jesus. What do we need to do to light a fire under some of these people? You know what I mean? Now, I know you two are laughing. You know what I'm laughing? I know you're laughing because you know what I'm talking about.
I do.
Right.
I do.
There's those emails that I'm, you know, I'm still on leave.
Oh, please.
Or I'll only get back to this after. And you're just like... Oh,
yeah,
dude,
I got one of those,
come on, really?
Those automated replies yesterday, and I was like, what the hell? Really? It's almost the middle of January. Like, end of this week is the middle of Jan. Then, I'm not going to take you seriously anymore if you say, oh, I've been working, last year I worked so hard. No, you didn't. You started halfway through the first month. That's not working hard. Get over it.
You've been off since the 15th. It's a month holiday. What are you, a baby?
So I got an automated reply because my email was to organize a meeting for next week, and I get this automated reply. Hi, whatever her name is, will only be in the office from the 28th or something. I'm like, what? Yeah. So that means she's going to be off for another 2 weeks. It's ridiculous. It's outrageous.
Oh, no.
She mustn't
take
leave.
Isn't it hard to get back into things when people are already into things? Like, everybody's found their groove.
Right.
And everybody's like, okay, this is what I'm doing this year. This is how I'm doing and working and allocating things.
Exactly.
And then here you come, my figures are, oh, gosh, sir.
Yeah.
What is the strategy for 2022? Well, no, Chief, we already know what we're doing. Let's go.
In other words, what you're saying here is this is for your own good that you get stuck in nice and early, because then you are in the swing of things while everybody else is still trying to catch up.
And it's annoying to hear about your holiday after we've already had two Monday morning meetings where Gladys had to get fired and she was my best friend at work. And now, oh, I was in the Camors with my husband. He's just the best. Like, we don't need that energy at the time when already we cling on for our job, man. Right.
Well, Gail Force says, I work in recruitment and I can't believe how many people you just can't get hold of taking their time to get into the work vibe again. Yeah. Listen, especially in a country like ours where you need to get going. She also says,
crazy.
If you have your own business, now is the time to pick up the slack and steal business from other companies. Exactly. Move quickly. Now's the time. Opportunity knocks. You heard what Sean said about the buyer's market in terms of crypto. It's just the same in every other kind of business. Because people do take a long time to get going in January, and if you can capitalize on that and take advantage of it, you can score big time. Speaking of scoring, Bulelo, there are two things I have to talk to you about. The first one is I want to know your take on the Djokovic situation. What are they calling him? Novaks.
Novaks Djokovic. Okay, and what's the other one?
The other one is this. This is a quickie, so you can maybe throw this in the beginning. Robin says, so excited for Malawi versus Zimbabwe, the football match on Thursday on the MKT show. So, yes, you guys have been doing some stuff with TikTok, and it's very cool. So tell me about that and which matches you are most excited about, and then we can get on to Novaks afterwards.
So we had last night was Nigeria, Egypt, which is two of the greatest African football countries. So we're doing it on TikTok. You can follow the MKT show. So it's a live watch along, really. It's just like, imagine we're sitting in your lounge, having a laugh, having a good one. And I'm bringing some friends with me, some which you've seen on the MKT show, some which are just my football watching mates and personal friends. So it's an awesome time, and it's awesome to be involved. And TikTok's a partner of AFCON, so it's quite cool to be plugged in, and and we'll bring you some nice surprises as things go on, which is quite cool that we're looking forward to bringing to people who watch with us. So the MKT show, TikTok, and look out on our social media for the games that'll be coming up. Zimbabwe, Malawi, of course, there's that. It's actually, there's a friendly rivalry, which was ugly about 20 years ago between Malawi and Zimbabwe. So we'll have that game from 5 o'clock on TikTok on Friday. So look out on our socials,
Very nice. That sounds excellent. Now, tell me about your take on this Novak Djokovic situation with the Aussie Open. Because I have some opinions, but they have nothing to do with actual sport. I want to hear what you think first as someone who's...
Well, I think Novak's a dickhead. I've always thought this. I mean, he's the greatest tennis player of all time. And there's no debating it.
Bigger than Nadal and Federer.
Not bigger, because he's not as liked. So he's always had this edge to him that you're now kind of seeing. He's always been a prickly guy, but he's known as the hardest working tennis player probably of all time. So I take nothing away from his greatness. He's the greatest, and he will have the most titles when it's all said and done. His body's holding up better than other guys, and he's already tied with them. So that I don't dispute, but he is a dickhead. And
why do you say outside the dickhead? Why you think
so? You know, outside of the sporting front of it, is that, and it's interesting to hear the hyper individualistic people come out in the support of the dictatorship of Australia and whatever. Is that my thing? Is this the very same people? I've never heard any of these individual rights people say, I want to take as much responsibility on the other side of my individual rights as exercising my individual rights. So I'm saying to Novak, don't vaccinate. Do your thing. When Australia say, not here, go home, chief. Like, I don't like that part, because there's a responsibility side as an individual. Exercise your individual rights. Don't vaccinate. Don't listen to anyone. But live with the absolute consequences of your actions is what I always say in a society. So I'm not about the Novak thing. And I'm an individualistic person, so suffer these things all the time.
There are two counter arguments that I want to bring up and see how you respond to them, because I don't really have a dog in this fight, but I don't particularly like Australia's draconian rules, and I don't like the way that they've locked down their entire civilization, and they think they can beat a virus, which they obviously can't, because apparently Omicron infections are through the roof in Australia right now, and they don't know what to do, because they've been unrealistic about what can be done here. But there are two things about Djokovic that I want you to try and address. First one is, he claims, and he won this point in court, which is a valid point, that he has natural immunity. He's already had COVID. He's tested positive for COVID before. He got over it. He has recovered. There are varying results from varying surveys that say that you're either more protected once you've got natural immunity, or at least as protected. as the vaccine, and nobody's disputing that. So he has natural immunity, therefore why does he have to go for the vaccination? It's a fair point. And I don't think anyone from the very hardcore scientists at the CDC who seem to be changing their tune every 3 seconds, the Faucis and the Rachel Walensky's and so on, these are the people who've been saying that natural immunity, they've been ignoring natural immunity as a viable excuse for people who don't want to get the vaccine, because they say they've already got the antibodies. And for all we know, they may be more protected, but certainly they're as protected as people who've had two vaccines and maybe even the booster, right? So there's that argument. The second argument is, how dare a nation of people where I'm sure the ministers certainly aren't as fit as the world's best tennis player, start telling a person who's come to their country, because their country sends out invitations to the best tennis players in the world to come there and win some money and participate in a massive sporting event, how can you then be such awful hosts? I mean, imagine me inviting you to a party at my house and saying to you, yes, but I want you to wear this, I want you to bring this as a gift, and I want you to give me a blood sample at the door. If I invite you to my country, the least I can do is be hospitable. And I can't, on the basis of, well, if one rule is for him, then one rule is for everybody, or you can't break the rules just because you're Novak Djokovic. That's not terribly hospitable of them. And they're a bunch of paranoids. So I'm not a huge fan of the Australian system or the way that they've handled COVID. They say they've done a great job, by the way. They say we've had the least deaths, we've had the least infections. And that may be true in some way, shape, or form. It turns out the Swedish example may, in the long run, be better than Australia's. We'll have to wait and see. In other words, the jury's still out. But how do you respond to those accusations? And even if you're not a big fan of Novak Djokovic, I can't say I'm the biggest fan of him or not, I'm kind of on his side with respect to the natural immunity and to the fact that the Australians are being very rude to a guest.
To the individual side. So I'll address it from the individual side. Imagine I came to your house, Gareth, and I took a dump in the middle of your lounge, right? And you came and said to me, dude, what the hell are you doing? I say, it's my individual right. Well, what's the problem, Gareth? I can do as I please. Now, that's an extreme example, but it's to say Australia can conduct themselves how they want. It's not for Novak Djokovic or anyone to tell. To be clear, I disagree with the way Australia are dealing with it as well, but it's not for anyone to go to Australia and tell them how they can run their country. Novak is welcome to behave how he wants in Serbia, right? So for me, I'm not a big part of that. I'm also not very big on people who always tell me about their individual rights. I want you to live those out so that you can be a part of the society. And please understand, it is okay for society to ostracize you if we feel it's not fit. Because you voted in, by living in the Western world, into democracy. And democracy isn't about the individual. It's what most people think. Now, are most people always right? Actually, it's well shown that most people are actually always in the wrong when they decide in crowds. But this is where we are, Novak. You're part of a democracy. Well, you cannot be an individual extreme.
So can we both agree then, because there is some middle ground here, that maybe the way that Novak should have handled this is say, all right, fine. If you're going to be so full of shit, and you're going to put me into some detention center, which they actually call them detention centers for starters.
That is a bit much.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Then I'm not coming. He should have said, fine, you want to have lower audiences because I bring a certain number of fans with me. Your event will not be as successful because you've got dumb rules. That's how I'm going to stand up to you. I'm not going to come because you're being inhospitable. So maybe he should have said to them from the start, sorry, guys, I'm out. And then it would have been within his – then basically the ball is in their court from there on. And no matter what they do, they're going to look stupid.
Absolutely. There we are, 100. That is the way to do it. If you're about that action, Novak, then I would have backed him. But there's an ugly side to it developing now, Gareth, is that Serbia has a certain context in the world. We don't have time to plug in their historical context, right? But there is this thing where his father has come out and compared Novak to the – shout out to the greatest staring of all time, Jesus Christ of Nazareth. So he's compared him to Jesus and how he's being treated. And you see, that's where it starts to get ugly. Once your troops are labeling you as some sort of martyr for the progress of mankind.
I mean, his dad is a propagandist. Come on, and that's what he's going to say. I don't take any of that seriously. I just want to go to some of the comments, because some people are agreeing with you, some people are not. Captain Cook says they gave him a visa and then they tried to retract it. So again, this is stupid bureaucracies. And by the way, this is another point that Hameen makes. It is what the Australian government wants. The people never got to vote on it. And that's true almost across the board in the world. If the people had a referendum on how the government should respond to COVID, I wonder if the governments would have been able to get away with what they got away with.
Sorry, I'm not so sure I want most people deciding by referendum, because I've said this before and I'll say it again. When we gave people freedom about 45 years ago, give or take, depending where you live in the Western world, the first thing they went and did was get obese. And the second thing they've done is get anxious. So maybe people aren't very good at knowing what's good actually. So I'm not big on letting the people decide. I'm very skeptical.
I'm going to do what a lot of lazy thinkers do when they get it to this point in an argument and say, you know, the words of Winston Churchill, which are that democracy may not be the best system, but it's the best of the worst systems.
Amen.
So
shout out.
There's no perfect way to do this. And if you think that there's a perfect way to do this, you're stupid. But I do think
100%.
You know, Robin says, for example, it's a rough Serbian coming out, he's low class, which sounds really shit. That's just a terrible argument. Novak simply saw how stupid Oz has been about this pandemic and he wanted to spread the message. That's from Freedom Fighter. Oh God, hang on. Sorry.
Serbian superstar, all-time tennis player.
Sorry,
and,
I got cut off. Sorry, guys. There are questions about Novak's positive test results, what he did the day after those from Bihleng. But really, I don't know that...
Well Gareth, you were gone there for a while, by the way.
Sorry.
I don't know if you know this.
Yeah, I just disappeared. Sorry, it wasn't my fault. Okay. It was a technical issue.
Oh, all right. Sorry, what were you saying in the background, though? Sorry, you just came in mid-sentence.
No, sorry, I was just reading some of the comments here, and like a lot of people, it's very polarized, right? And I saw a lot of this on social media as well. Again, as someone who's not the world's biggest tennis fan, it's amazing how even people like me are now required to have a stance on Novak Djokovic. And depending on your stance on Novak Djokovic, that tells people a whole lot more about you in other things. So... now suddenly, if I'm in support of Novak Djokovic instead of the Australian government, oh, well, I must be this kind of a person. You know what I mean? You're categorized.
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. Not how the world works.
Sipua, anyway. You got nothing to say about this, or do you?
No. Nothing at all. This is not my era of expertise. No. You know, sometimes you must just learn to zip it and just be like, okay, guys, I'll see ya.
Well, I have to say also, I'm again thrilled that I live here and I've lived here during lockdown, because we just don't care about rules in this country. And as much as people like Mbulelo go on about how, you know, the good of the majority and blah, 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 whatever. I mean, he's a bit of a utopian lefty. We know that about you, right, Mbulelo?
Yeah, I am.
But
absolutely.
I would rather leave it to individuals. In an open market, in a free market system, the price of things is better determined by all people acting as individuals. And the same thing goes for laws, and the same thing goes for pandemics, and the same thing goes for everything. When you let individuals make their own decisions, sure, some of them are going to make terrible decisions, and they will pay the price individually for that. And maybe there's a price for society at large, but I think I'd still rather err on the side of the individuals than let a draconian government make a rule. And I'm not saying this is Australia in this example. It could be any government, could be any rule. But I'd rather have that than a bunch of bureaucrats or a bunch of elected officials who basically won a popularity contest deciding for individuals what should happen. And you're either on one side or the other. So maybe that's what this argument boils down to. If you're a Novak Djokovic supporter through this whole Australian Open fiasco, then maybe you're just more on the side of the individuals. If you are one of the people who's on the side of the Australian government here and you think Novak Djokovic should just do what he's told, you're obviously on the side of big government. You're on the side of being told what to do. You're on the side of the greater good. And that's just as simple as it is. So you've got to choose your position, and probably the two dovetail quite well into each other.
Good luck to him.
Yeah, well.
Good luck to Novak.
Robin thinks he's a terrible person. Sven says Novak had COVID. That doesn't mean he is anti-vax. What has Brittany got to say about this? Let's go deeper, says Michael. Jesus.
Guys, leave Britney alone.
Yeah.
Hands off Britney, guys. Leave her alone. She's living her best life doing whatever she's doing right now. Leave her alone.
Exactly. And this is an argument I've heard a couple of times. Tiger says, you can't allow freedoms if it causes the death of others. But being, you know, even if you are a carrier or you're positive for Omicron, the chances of you killing anyone is minuscule. You've got a bigger chance of killing anyone by getting in your car this morning and driving to work. And, you know, the chances of you having an accident and killing someone are probably higher than your chances of killing someone with Omicron in your system. So that's not an argument, with all due respect, Tiger. I don't think that that's a fair argument at all. And the Australians have this hyper, like, vigilant, hyper-security state, nanny state approach to things where the government's going to protect you from things. I'm afraid if you believe that, if you really think that the government can protect you from things, talk to anyone in South Africa who has been waiting for government service delivery in a rural town. Let's see how you feel about it then. Let's have that argument once you've spoken to them. Then we can talk. How about that? It's also interesting. Sven says a lot of these anti-vaxxers believe over here that that's the case. And a lot of other people are talking about, you know, we've got both sides of the argument, which is what I love about this audience that we've got here, is that people have, you know, nuanced approaches to this. And there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. Tracy says, two wrongs in this situation. Novak's conduct and his arrogance. Has he really displayed arrogance, though, in this particular thing? He hasn't made any statements on television. It's mostly been his dad who's been talking. You know, a lot of people like to attribute arrogance to a sports star who frankly deserves to be arrogant. I mean, if you're the best in the world, good for you. Be arrogant. What are ordinary nobodies who have no physical skills whatsoever and no training and no ability to win a goddamn thing, are they going to sit around and call you arrogant? Well, if you're Novak Djokovic, ignore them. Who cares what your opinion is of him? And then Australia's revoking of his visa and treatment. There are no winners here, says Tracy. Maybe.
So I think just to give some context on that visa story is that there was a massive confusion between the tennis tour and the government regulations. And that's where the problem's coming, is that they weren't exactly in lockstep of how to deal with the situation. The tennis association presumed that they had been given clearance, but actually the Australian government's now saying, Who did you talk to here, gentlemen? Were you in Rongarua or whatever ridiculous places they have in Australia?
Even in the Australian government, they can't figure out whose responsibility it is. Is it border control? Is it Melbourne? Is it the state of Victoria? Is it the Premier of Victoria? Is it the Health Minister for Australia? You know, again, this is the problem with governments, is they can never, ever take responsibility for anything. They want to make the rules, but when it comes to being accountable, No, it's not an individual thing. That's the problem with those non-individual types.
Yeah. The problem with governments, especially in this performative nature, is that they're always trying to be perfect, right? And actually, the smartest people in the world, if you go to a Buffett or Adrian Gore or these guys, they're always trying to find the most reasonable way to do things. Smart people don't try and be perfect. Yeah. What is the most reasonable way to do things? And I just think the whole situation is now getting unreasonable from every side.
One last thing on this this whole COVID thing, because we haven't really spoken about COVID, thank God, this week. But it's interesting what developments have occurred in the last while. The CDC, who I mentioned just a short while ago, these are the guys who were deciding who and what was spreading misinformation over the last couple of years. They came out very clearly the other day and said that almost all the COVID deaths that have occurred since the beginning of this pandemic, almost all of them have occurred with people who have four or more comorbidities. So in other words, people who were not very healthy to start with. And guess what? That's going to happen with almost every disease. So again, have we overreacted to this whole thing? Probably. That's all I'm saying. Probably. And there's a huge difference between the word probably and possibly and the word definitely. Obviously, so look it up. All right, that's enough. We've got time for that's all we got time for now on that front. But I do want to turn our attention to a man. I had the pleasure of working with him for some time at 702. He's written a great book which came out last year. We were going to talk to him last year about the book, but we for various reasons and mostly around scheduling didn't get around to it. I'm thrilled though to have him with us today. His book is called I Don't Want to Die Unknown. We need to listen to our inner voice. and his name is Dan Moyane. Dan Moyane is going to join us in just a second to talk about his book, and I'm thrilled to speak to Dan. It has been a while. I had some interaction with him when we were both at ENCA a short while ago. I had a show there until, what was it, June or July of last year, and every time I saw Dan, I would smile, and he's got just a big heart, a great mind. He's made a huge contribution to broadcasting, but we also worked together many years before that when he was my boss at Prime Media and I was doing the morning show on 702. He, of course, has a very interesting, colorful, and amazing story to tell about his life in broadcasting. We'll talk a little bit about that, too. I'm pleased to welcome to the show this morning Mr. Dan Moyane. How are you, sir?
Morning, Gareth. I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
It's nice to see you, Dan. How's everybody? How's the family? And how was your Christmas and New Year?
Well, everybody's okay. Christmas was quiet, but as you know, we were very busy after Archbishop Desmond Tutu passed away on Boxing Day. So that last week of December, from a media perspective, was a little bit active. But other than that, all is good. Thanks for asking. And how are you?
No, I'm very good. Listen, Dan, first of all, congrats on the book. It's a tremendous thing to be able to put your story down. And you tell your story from your earliest days and kind of how you grew up and in Soweto, how the title of your book comes about, because you were lying there in 1969, the very year that Armstrong walked on the moon. And you said to yourself, and I think this is so important because often people talk about, manifesting. And here you said to yourself as a kid, I don't want to die unknown. I want people to know that I lived and that I made a contribution. And so many years later, I don't think anyone would doubt that you've done exactly that. How important was it? A lot of people make these stories up when they look back in their lives. But how important was it to you to have said those words to yourself then and having that self-belief that you clearly did at that stage and working hard, as you also did, through the course of your career to get to this point? I mean, it must feel good. And at the same time, it helps you to share with other people that it's within their power to do the same, right?
Yes, indeed, Gareth. I mean, just to rewind a little bit, remember, I'm a 10-year-old boy, and this big story that we're hearing about is this moon landing. There's no television in South Africa those years, so we're not seeing this thing on any screens. It's on radio. My dad was an ardent radio listener, plus an ardent reader. Not having gone to school himself, he really uplifted himself by learning how to read and write in different languages. So he listens to radio, and that's the news. So the very first thought is not exactly like, I don't want to die alone. The thought is, looking up at the moon, and I recall this very clearly, asking my mom, but where are these guys? Because, I mean, silly old me, I'm thinking, when you look up at the moon, you see people, walking on, on the moon.
Well, you were 10.
As a 10-year-old. And my mom just laughs and chuckles. And then the weeks after, and in that time, and the months after, I have this feeling in me that starts like, how sad it would be for me to have lived, been born and existed, and only known to my parents, my immediate relatives, family and friends, my colleagues and stuff. It even becomes stronger. Hence, I had an aunt, Tandi, may her soul rest in peace. She was a matron at the Baragwanath Hospital. So we get to visit her sometimes, and I'm surrounded by these images of men and women in white uniform wearing stethoscopes, others not wearing stethoscopes. And when I walk there, I'm hearing all the time people being called, Dr. So-and-so, please come to ward number what, we are needed here. And I'm thinking, wow, how cool it would be one day for me, people to be walking and they hear, Dr. Moyane, you're needed here and there.
Yeah.
So that feeling just grew and grew and grew. And I knew very early on then that I would have to do things, I would have to live my life in a way that would make me known beyond my immediate circle.
Dan, your microphone is rubbing on your collar there. If you can just pull that away from your collar, it'll help us to just hear you a little bit better. The mic on your headphones. Yeah, if you just pull that away from it's just clipping a little bit there. So there we go.
Okay.
That's a whole lot better. So Dan, I mean, why write the book though? Because this is, you know, you're a man who's still very much involved in the media. Many of us.
Sipiwe warned me about this.
No problem. Sipiwe is here to admonish you this morning as well. But Dan, you know, You wrote this book, but you're on our screens daily. You're one of those people who brings us the news. You've been in management in broadcasting for a while. You've understood everything there is to do in radio. You've pretty much done it all. And you also have a really interesting story to tell in terms of, you know, your political background and what you were doing in Mozambique for all those years. There's the lovely story of how you met your wife at the time. And, you know, there's some stories about what you've done in business since. Your kids, how they come into the story. But to write this stuff is hard work. What made you decide to do the book? Because you have a pretty full plate already. It's not like you're sitting around doing nothing.
Gareth, as far back as 2015, I was asked by different people all the time. Each time I engage with people, particularly young people in my circles, people younger than me. And when I shared some stories, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, at my age, one has gone through a lot. I mean, I've spent like, this is my 42nd year in media. And through that time, as you reflect, and people say, but you must put that down. Maybe you should write a book. Maybe you should. So I started in 2015 on my own to say, let me just put some thoughts down and stuff. So it was brought on by people around me and my family as well, saying, hey, you know, you've got such a some interesting stories. And I would share them sometimes around the dinner table with my kids, and they say, wow, Dad, what about this? What about that? Then I realized one thing, Gara. And that came even crystal clear last year. In the middle of this pandemic, we're all reflecting about all kinds of things, as you know, and the meaning of everything. And we're all sometimes so uncertain and sometimes confused. So it came to me that in line with that, it would be so tragic for me to have done everything I've done. And if I'm blessed one day, if I'm blessed one day with grandchildren, and then this line of the Moyana family continues, and one day they'll be sitting in the future. You know, imagine the year 2050. I'll be long dead. I'll be a fossil by 2050. And they say, but who was this guy? And maybe they find out. And there's nowhere to go and find stuff.
Yeah.
And in today's world where narratives come and go so quickly and people influence things, I thought, let me put thoughts down. So as a legacy, hence I say the book is part memoir, part legacy. So I've put down what my father could not do, my mom could not do. They had very rich stories and histories and backgrounds, as you find out when you read the book.
Yes.
But that was all oral history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, normally you will tell your story better than me. I can't tell Gareth Cliff's story.
Mm-hmm.
Only Gareth can tell his story better than me. Sipiwe will be the best person to tell the Sipiwe story better than anybody else. So I thought then last year, suddenly, by the end of last year, it clicked. And my younger son, who's my namesake, made me do stuff that I never thought I would do. And a couple of other people I was interacting with, they said, no, you must set up a YouTube channel. You must talk to people. I said, no, I'm not Gareth Cliff. Gareth Cliff knows these online things better than me. But everybody's doing it. So I said, as part of that journey of part memoir, part legacy, I will write a book. So the decision was finally made in December 2020.
I love the answer because you also include the stories of your parents. And I think this is something that so many of us miss out on. You know, unless you are the kind of person who likes to dig around and do the historical research, and let's also admit that that's hard work, that's tough to do. Many South Africans and many black South Africans grow up with only the oral history, and they miss out on a lot of the stuff because obviously – you know, there's a broken telephone that happens, so stuff is lost along the way. There are many great stories that people don't remember exactly. You know, the people who you talk to, the elders in the family, they often forget things because they're very old by the time young people start to take an interest in them. And I think this is really important. I think your book is also a bit of a call to all of us to just write down our own stories. Your subtitle to your book is We Need to Listen to Our Inner Voice. But I think the lesson that I took out of this, especially hearing the stories about your mom and dad, was that we need to appreciate people while they're around and write down some of the things while we have them in our lives. Go to your old people in your family and sit down with them and talk to them and get these stories, because it's part of who you are and it's part of what you hand on to your kids or to your nephews or your nieces or whoever it might be. This is how we enrich our cultural tapestry. I love it.
Yeah, no, you know, Gareth, you've used a word there, some words that my father used to use. My father died in 2007. He was 94, you know, and the bloody bugger decided to die on Christmas Eve. So that we'll never forget, because he was a Christian. So when comes that time, every year on Christmas Eve, we know that it's my dad's time, and I can never forget. So we honor him by going to his gravesite, paying our respects on Christmas Eve, okay? So I used to laugh that he's got a very funny sense of humor in a way. So the point is, Gareth, we have to appreciate ourselves and the people around us while they are around. My father used to say, don't thank me when I'm lying in my coffin. When you've bought this expensive coffin and you've covered it with this expensive blanket and you are hosting this beautiful funeral, I'm not there. I won't be able to enjoy anything. You want to buy me a suit? Buy me while I can wear it and use it. Don't wait until I'm in my coffin and then buy the suit and show off to people that you were looking after me when you were not. So my dad used to do the same. My father, I would go to Soweto, a White City Jobavu, when they're still alive, buy him something. He'll thank me. When, as soon as I give it to him, he said, oh, thank you, my son. I said, but Dad, you always thank me. I'm your son. I must do this. He said, no, I must always thank you so you can hear it, that I'm appreciative. So you're right. We need to appreciate. And there's a lot of rich tapestry that we all come from in Southern Africa. Beautiful stories. And as I said in my introduction of the book, if my story or part of what I've written resonates, one thing resonates with one individual, then I would have achieved something with the book in terms of the legacy. And that's really the point, because we come from such rich backgrounds. I mean, you all remember the famous I'm an African speech by the former President Thabo Mbeki in May 1996. Yes, at a celebration, of the Constitution some years ago. I mean, in it, he starts by tracing his roots as an African. And that DNA, that tapestry you're talking about, that comes from Europe. It comes from the Khoisan. Mm-hmm. It comes from Malaysia, Cape Malay slaves. It comes from India with our Indian compatriots. It comes from the hinterland of Southern Africa with migrant mine workers from Botswana, Lesotho, Eswatini, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Malawi, over decades, not last year. Yep. Not 2 years ago, absolutely. Over decades, you know, from the time that gold mines were discovered in the 1800s in Johannesburg. So we all have something that we can pass on and share. And the biggest lesson for me was that there's nothing, Gareth, as uplifting as knowing where you come from, who you are, how you come to being, and how you interact with the rest of the world. So when writing this book, at some points, I mean, I had tears in my eyes, a lump in my throat, I had laughter, and I thought, wow, you know, I've been so blessed. And I don't take it for granted, and I'm not saying it because we're talking about the book, but it is just that I've had a damn fortunate life all over these years. Because if I look around me, things could have been worse for me.
Dan, I want to get into your career. I also want Simpiwe and Bulelo to jump in here, because it's not really just an interview with me and you about your book, although there's lots about your career that we can still get into. Mariska says in the comments, hi, Dan, it's awesome to see one of my favorite people on one of my favorite shows. And a lot of people here saying that they absolutely love you on TV. They loved you on radio. Some people bringing up Shosho Loza back in 1995, which was a big thing. I mean, didn't you win some kind of record-breaking South African Music Award for that? You did, didn't you?
No, you're putting me right up there at the level of the Summer Awards. No, I never got there. But what happened, it hit in terms of my CD, the Shosho Loza one, was called a mini CD. The reason is it didn't have 10 or more tracks. Yeah. Okay? So it was less than that. Yeah. And for that kind of an album at that time, if you sold plus 20,000 copies in a short space of time, you became a gold. So I got awarded a gold thing by Sony BMG. Wow. That is a company that published it, because within a week within a week, it sold more than 20,000 copies. And then it can continue on to sell more. You know, thank you very much for people who are listening and passing their regards. I appreciate it. Your other colleague you said is what? It's
Mbulelo. Mbulelo.
What is the name? Sorry.
Mbulelo.
Mbulelo. Thank you very much, Mbulelo.
Yeah, so,
Mbulelo, I apologize.
No problem. Dan,
you're not the first.
Let them jump in because I'm sure they've watched you on TV and they want to know something about how the current news job goes. I want to go back a little bit further, but let them have a go first. Mbulelo and Sipiwe, you obviously know who Dan is. What do you want to know about this man? He's got a long and interesting history in the world of broadcasting.
Well, I'd like to start by asking, what is your favorite childhood memory? Because you've written this book now and you had to go down memory lane, and I'm sure that's sparked up something where you're like, oh, yeah, if I could go back a couple of years when I didn't have to pay bills, that would be great.
My favorite childhood memory, when there will be family gatherings. My father belonged to a society that was at Family Links, and then they'll come together because on that day they will be singing, you know, traditional songs and hymns and stuff, and you could eat anything you wanted to, and you didn't have to wait for Christmas because you get jelly and custard on the day, and there'll be khmer and stuff. So whenever the society came together, I think they used to meet like 4 times a year kind of thing, not regularly. And then they will go around. So wherever we went, and it also meant we traveled. It also meant it was an opportunity to leave White City, and we'll be going either to Telisa, we'll be going to Pretoria, we'll be going out of my normal thing. So it came with a bit of a travel, came with a bit of fun, and a little bit of that free, you know, being free as a child, because the parents were busy with their meeting, doing their stuff. You were running around and doing whatever you wanted on that particular. That's just one of my favorite moments. With the family.
I just want to show everybody, because there's some beautiful pictures in your book too. There's a picture of your father just dressed incredibly beautifully. He's a very elegant man, but I noticed that his surname was Moyana. So how did it become Moyane?
Okay. I mentioned it in the book. My father, when he went to register me in the Department of Native Affairs, in November 1959, after I was born in August, the gentleman who helped him, was a white Afrikaner who misspelled my name.
Right.
My full name is Daniel Tsakani Moyane, but we are Moyanas. Mm. So instead of putting a Moyana, he must have heard the Moyane, he put an E at the end. And as you know, in Brakpan on the east end, in Ekuruleni, in Gauteng, there's a township called Tsakane,
yes,
but it ends with an E, but this guy decided to spell mine with an I. So I'm the only Tsonga man who spells his Tsakane with an E, with an I instead of an E, and I'm the only Moyana who spells Moyana with an E at the end. So in 1977, my dad said, hey, man, you are now older, you must get your pass and stuff, you know, this... the government, the police will arrest you and stuff. So he insisted. So we went to New Canada. Then it was the Department of Bantu Affairs. That's in the 70s now. And the guy there as well, I was there. He refused to change it. My father was explaining to him, showed him his own pass. He said, here's my pass. I'm Moyana. He's my son. He said, hey, the birth certificate says Moyane, so that's all we're doing.
Oh, wow.
So that's it. And my father said, my son, don't worry. You are a Moyana. You know that you are a Moyana. And that's all that matters. So he said, don't worry about changing it. And then later on, I thought, with democracy, I said, let me go to Home Affairs and change it. People are changing names, people dropping, using certain names and incorporating new names. And I said, to go back there, I mean, everything I've done, even my kids, my 4 kids, they're Moyanes with an E. I registered them like that. And I said, it doesn't really matter. We are all Moyanas. It's fine. So that's how it happened. And Gareth is not, I'm not the only one. I'm sure there are millions of South Africans with similar stories.
Plenty.
With similar stories. Yes.
Dan, the story of meeting your wife, I mean, this is so interesting because radio is such a big part of your life. You mentioned how your father was a big radio listener, and that might have been how you initially started to develop a love for the medium. But everything in your life seems to have also had radio in it in some way, shape, or form. You know, meeting your wife, kind of the Mozambique connection. And we'll talk a little bit about your role in politics in Maputo and how important Maputo was in your story too. Perhaps you could just give us an oversight of what that all means, because there are some themes that come through the book, and radio is definitely one of them.
Yeah. Remember, when I grew up, I, like most black South Africans, we had very limited career opportunities. And there were few of them that were seen as prestigious by families. You know, if you became a teacher, you know, the family's name becomes more respected. Maybe a lawyer, even a clerk. You work as a clerk. You said, hey, my son, umfana wami umabhalane. My son is a clerk. You know, it's like a big thing then. You work in an office, you're a clerk, you know. Or you became a police officer. You know, people say, oh, you're a police, you know. Or you wanted something more. And if you wanted something more, you had to be a doctor. So the influence around me, that when I grew up, I wanted to be a doctor, I wanted to be a pediatrician. But as you said correctly, I was growing up in a home where, fortunately, I was exposed to news and current affairs very early on. My dad used to consume that like nobody's business, bringing home his boss's Rand Daily Mail every day. I don't know if many people remember the newspaper in the old days, the Rand Daily Mail. And then also listening to radio, like English radio service on SABC, Radio Zulu, now Ukhozi FM, and sometimes Springbok Radio, you know, Springbok Radio. And later on, we used to listen to LM Radio on shortwave. So those influences are there, but I don't really pay much attention to them when I'm growing up, because I want to be a doctor and I wanted to be a pediatrician. So now I end up in Mozambique after 1976. I went there in 1979. And then I get there, literally, Gareth, and I always tell people, it's like I fell into the world of media. Why? Because when I got there, young, 19-year-old, looking for opportunities, trying to find a political home and finding the ANC and joining the ANC there, I was also looking for a job. I needed an upkeep. I needed to survive. And I used to write what I regarded as good poetry. Looking back, I don't think it was. I lost most of my poems then. But one of them was published. One of them was published by the weekly Maputo newspaper magazine called Tempo, which literally means time in Portuguese. So it was a weekly current affairs. I bumped into this guy at the magazine when I went cheekily. You know, when you are young and militant, nothing is impossible. So I walked in there and said, hi, I'm from Soweto. I've got a poem. Can you publish it? And this guy, Zé Batista, I learned his name later, looked at me and fortunately spoke some English. He said, okay, I'll translate it for you. We'll publish it. And I wanted it to be published around about June 16. It was about June 16. And I published it under my African name, Tsakane, correctly spelled, you'll be pleased to know,
right,
with an E at the end.
Uh-huh.
And in Maputo, they know their stuff there. So, but unfortunately, the last few pages where they used to dedicate this for some literature were packed. So they published it in September that year and everything. And that relationship with Zé Batista developed into making me getting into the media. He then invited me for dinner over his home. And he was living with one of Mozambique's veteran journalists today, one of the top journalists today, Fernando Lima, is still around, and introduced me to Fernando Lima, who then introduced me to Mr. Ian Christie, who was the editor of the English publication of the Mozambique News Agency, government-owned. Remember, Gareth, Mozambique at the time was one-party state.
That's right.
Led by Frelimo, yes, at the time. So everything was government-owned and state-run and stuff like that. And then that's how it happened. But in that, I then get into radio at a very historic time in Southern Africa through Mr. Ian Christ, who then employs me as a young intern. They then set up a new radio station in English the day after Robert Mugabe and the rest of ZANU-PF freedom fighters went back to Salisbury, now Harare.
Right.
In 1980, they used to broadcast a Chimurenga radio, Radio Freedom of ZANU from Maputo, using certain frequencies. And Frelimo decided they didn't want to lose those frequencies. They wanted to keep them. So they turned it into an English radio station. And its one aim was to counter apartheid propaganda in Southern Africa. That's to broadcast the other side. To broadcast the other side. Because shortwave, you can listen to shortwave radio from anywhere, as you know.
That's right.
FM is limited. This is way before internet radio now. People are listening to us, hopefully in Beijing or maybe in Oslo, I don't know, where you've got your audience. I understand you've got a global audience, so I'm sure people are watching us from all over. But those days, shortwave was like that. You could just tune in. You find it on your transistor radio anywhere. So that was the idea. That's what happens, literally. So I fell into it when I was looking for a job. I didn't go there saying, I want to be a journalist, I want to be media. And by the end of 1980, I was bloody in love with this thing. You know, really, I just loved it because I discovered I love telling stories. And then I was really trained. I mean, Ian Kiss is a Scotsman. His soul rest in peace. And he passed away here in Johannesburg at my home of throat cancer in the year 2000. And they trained me. I mean, Gareth, you guys, I don't know, you guys are having it nice and easy. You, when you started at 702, you had it very easy there, you bloody bugger. When we started, for nine months, I used to make tea and coffee for the editors, run errands, go and buy a newspaper, go downstairs, upstairs.
Listen, I didn't have it easy. I did have to make coffee and tea for John Robbie, and you know what a nightmare
Not for me.
You know what
not
a nightmare.
For me. I was your boss. You never made it for me. You made it for John Robbie.
You were so important.
You didn't make it for me.
You were so important. You were already like two floors up by then. When I joined, you were already deputy chairperson. You'd long ago left us broadcasters behind.
Let's leave it in the past. Ladies, please, let's put our handbags away. You've both done fine.
Mbulelo, thank you. But anyway, it took me about 9 months. So in that space, that's 1980. So like today in South Africa with skills development, what do you call it? Learnerships. Companies do learnerships, do internships when you get young people who come in as interns. Radio Mozambique was doing it then, way back in the 70s and the 80s. So every year they would go to secondary schools around to go and speak to high school students, you know, your grade 10s, grade 11s, to say, you know, maybe you can consider a career in media. My current wife, Odette, was at the Matola Secondary School, and then she was one of those who was then enticed, excited, and attracted to radio in 1982. So I was already in radio 2 years, and then one of the days I'm walking out of the building, there's a group of students, and then there's this young sexy thing standing there, and I'm thinking, oh, who's that one? Dressed very colorfully. In the book, there's a picture.
Yes.
I put a picture, but it's in black and white.
Yes.
She was dressed exactly like that.
But you do
and
explain.
I still remember
colors. Yeah, you say in the picture, because it's beautiful. I mean, again, this is just part of what's in this incredible book. But you say the outfit she was wearing when I first saw her, if the photo was in color, this is what you would see: an orange top and a skirt with green, orange, and white stripes. And this is the picture here. Which is, I mean, you can hardly see it. I'm not giving it any justice. But that's the picture of your wife when you first saw her. What an amazing thing to have. So many people can only describe their very bad memory of the first time they met the love of their life. But you actually have a picture of her in that outfit. That's amazing.
Yeah, I saw her. Let me correct. I didn't meet her that day. I saw her and I got hooked like crazy. And then a few weeks later, the same group came back. And there she was now, dressed differently. And then I made the first move. I don't even know what to say. The rest is history. That's 1982. So it was very fortunate for me that I was in radio at the time, and then she happened to be in radio, and then I was growing in radio at the time. So radio just carried me through up to 1989, at a very historic time in the country, when the Nationalist Party government under de Klerk decides to free some veteran political leaders like Walter Sisulu, Govan Mbeki, Andrew Mlangeni, Elias Motsoaledi, Raymond Mhlaba, and the rest of them, ahead of Mandela being released in 1990. And that time, one of the radio stations in South Africa that I didn't know existed was Radio 702. Radio 702 started in 1980. I'd left the country then, long ago. So I did not know about Radio 702. But then they needed a correspondent on a story following an attack. There was civil war in Mozambique at the time, as you know, with Renamo and stuff like that. And then their normal regular host, a friend of mine, Carl Meyer, was gone, had traveled. Then they found me via the BBC. By then, I was a correspondent for BBC World Service Focus on Africa program on radio. Now it's also on TV. Before, they had a TV program. So they called me. They found my number via the BBC. And that's when I got to know 702. And I met a lady whom I still regard as one of the best current affairs producers this country has had in radio, Debbie Mayer today. She was then Debbie Debbie Hewitz, you know.
That's
Debbie
right.
Hewitz.
That's right.
And Debbie Mayer today. And she called me, and then I was very suspicious. I thought it was the SABC. I wouldn't do anything for the SABC, which was run by the National Party at the time. and then also risk being known as maybe somebody who's a traitor or betraying the revolution, or, you know, because the SABC right. was the enemy, Absolutely. Part of the enemy establishment at the time. So that's when I met Radio 702 when I came back home. I then introduced myself to Mike Wills. You remember him?
Yep.
He was the editor, news editor, and then I met the rest of the gang there, the likes of him and Chris Gibbons and the rest. Then S702 was downtown. So my journey in radio began way back in 1980 when I was looking for a job to survive. And then the rest, is, as they say, is history. And I mean, I still love radio to bits today. I don't mind television. And at ENC, they know that. I just wish I could go on air without makeup, because I think I'm pretty handsome without.
Yeah, Dan, you've aged well. I mean, I don't think that you look any older than when I first met you at 702. Although looking at these pictures, which goes back all the way to the 1950s, you know, you've changed if you look at the book. But I do have to say, because we've almost run out of time here, and I could talk to you all day. It's really such a pleasure to see someone who's got such a lovely story to tell, and you're so humble about your incredible achievements. You've been in important management roles. You've been the person who's been there to tell us about massively historical events, whether it's on TV or on radio over the last couple of years. And it's just so good to spend time talking to you about a career that deserves the amount of attention and love that you do get from the audiences who love you. And Dan, it's just great to see your book. You also include in here ways people can keep in touch with you. The book is called I Don't Want to Die Unknown. You don't have to worry about that, my friend. It's an incredible story. Dan Moyani's book, please pick it up. It's also available as an ebook. And I'm sorry we're out of time, because I don't think we even scratched the surface of all the things that we could get into there. But some beautiful, beautiful stories. Dan, thank you. What time are you on TV today?
I'm not on today. I'll be back on Monday. I've just taken a bit of time out. I've got other things that I'm busy with today and tomorrow. I'll be back on Monday. It's from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the afternoon on ENCA. As you say, hashtag DSTV403.
There we go. Dan Moyani, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mbulelo. Nice meeting you. And thank you, Spiwe. Thank you very much. I'm sure we'll catch up again. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Great to meet. It's great to meet a fellow social and cultural commentator.
Mbulelo thinks he's on your level. It's outrageous. But thank you so much. Simpiwe and Mbulelo, you hardly got a word in edgewise this morning. It's my fault, but it was good to catch up with you, Dan. And we'll speak soon.
Thank you. Have a great year, guys. Thank you very much.
Dan. Happy New Year.
You too.
Absolutely. Dan Moyani, and always good to see him. Great to catch up with him. I'm sorry I hardly let you guys have a chance.
He's a legend. Certified.
Yeah,
amazing. He's a legend.
Amazing guy. All right, that is it for today. We will see you tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. bright and early every day with lots and lots of good stuff. And tomorrow also, of course, the Burning Platform makes its return to cliffcentral.com with Pumi Mashiko and a whole lot more. Stick around. Cheers. See you tomorrow. Cliffcentral.com.